This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Donald Kennedy, who is President Emeritus of Stanford University, Bing Professor of Environmental Science and Policy, and Editor-in-Chief of Science, the Journal of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He was Commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration from 1977 to 79. He is on the Berkeley campus to deliver the Clark Kerr Lectures. Dr. Kennedy, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you very much. It's been a great day for me, actually.
Very good. And let's talk a little about what brought you here, going back all the way to the beginning. Where were you born and raised?
Well, I was born and raised in New York City, and then we lived in various places in southern New England, including the Pioneer Valley in western Massachusetts, which was a place where I sort of got to enjoy nature. Mm-hmm. And then I went to jumping around with a father who was in the Air Force. Yeah. So we lived in Florida. We lived in the aforementioned southern New England places, once outside Washington, and then at war's end in Detroit.
Mm-hmm. And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
It's hard to tell. My father was a writer and editor of his own, who had a failed but interesting career as a publisher, and then he went to work for a New York advertising agency. And then just after Pearl Harbor, although he had been in World War I, decided he was just barely young enough for another war, so he went into the Air Force, not as a pilot, but as a sort of strategist. And those were interesting times. I got to live on an air base in Florida and go to high school in the South for a year, which was interesting. And so I suppose that the experience of being a little unrooted and moving around from place to place and getting different experiences about nature. Mm-hmm. Central Florida during the war was an extraordinary place for somebody in which to get interested in natural history.
Were there any teachers as a young person who gave you the science bug / nature bug?
Not particularly. I think my father's curiosity and interest in encouraging that side of me was probably more important to me than teachers I had in high school. But my interest in nature developed while I was in college, even though I rebelled a little bit because I couldn't get, as a Harvard undergraduate, enough of what I called critter biology. I was sort of interested in, I suppose, in ecology and animal behavior and that sort of thing. And I found teachers there that were very encouraging to that sort of thing, but I found more of a meeting of that kind of interest when I spent summers at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole or at the University of Michigan Biological Station in upstate Michigan.
And where did you do your undergraduate work?
I did it at Harvard.
And your graduate work also?
Graduate work also at Harvard. I did something I never advise students to do these days. You should leave your your natal place and go elsewhere for your doctoral education. But I changed fields so much that it wasn't as much of a handicap as it sometimes is for me.
What do you mean that you changed fields? I mean, subfields within biology?
Yeah, I became much more interested in the nervous system and in electrophysiology and mapping neuronal connections and discovering how preassembled wiring in the nervous system produces stereotype behavior. That was what I did for most of my active scientific life.
Mm-hmm. And is that what you did your dissertation on at Harvard?
Yeah.
And were you work? I guess you were looking primarily at mammals or all kinds of animals.
Worked on frogs because frogs have an interesting metamorphosis that involves re-engineering of portions of the nervous system and the sensory system. I actually would kind of look around for a preparation. A particular system that would answer a question I had. So we were interested in stereotyped locomotor behavior and worked on crayfish. I worked at some points on insects. So it was a matter of finding a place in which you could ask an interesting question.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, what do you think are the skills that are required that students should have or acquire if they're going to do biology, do science?
I think a lot depends on the student. I think there are many students who are able to exploit a particular set of technical skills, interest in and competence in instrumental engineering and so forth, that bring new tools to the task. There are also others who are driven primarily by a kind of imaginative curiosity and look around for places in which there might be an opportunity to answer a question. And then there are others who approach science in a very self-disciplined way, trying to figure out what the really important questions are, and saying, "I don't want to waste my time with anything less important than what I'm really focused on." So curiosity is a big element.
Curiosity. What about mathematical skills? Increasingly.
Increasingly, that's an important attribute. I don't think, for example, one could be an ecologist 30, 40 years ago. Without understanding the mathematics that one needs to know to think about population dynamics and demographics of natural populations. Now mathematical ecology is an important discipline of its own.
What about qualities of character? I guess perseverance, patience are important?
Patience is hugely important, relentlessly curious people often don't have quite enough of it. That is, the temptation to quit one question because something else suddenly looms up in your peripheral vision and you say, oh my goodness, I really ought to do that. And I think a capacity to stay focused and to realize that there's an outcome to this particular line of work and to refuse to be diverted by something interesting that appears at the edge.
The monetary success that one can have these days in making discoveries in biology, do you think that's affecting who's going in to the sciences, especially the biological sciences? Or are you still getting the same curious kind of student that you were getting before?
I think it's pretty much the same. What concerns me more is that the introduction of a new set of incentives, some of them financial, in fact, most of them financial, to add to the old incentives of the prestige economy, mean that some university faculty members, for example, are at least at the edge, tempted to change fields to get into something where there might be a larger return. But I don't want to sound critical because sometimes it's a larger return in the sense of value to human societies, and it may be also a larger return in the sense of return to the institution or to the investigator herself or himself.
When you came to Stanford, you were involved, I know, as chairman of the department and played a very important role in reorganizing the teaching of the biological sciences at Stanford. This is before you became president. Talk about that a little, because it seems that happened at a very important moment in the history of the biological sciences. What were the challenges?
Well, I think we reached some collective decisions in the department in the 1963, 64, 65 period, at which departmental leadership looked as though it were about to change, and it, in fact it did. I became chairman in 1964. We had all thought that the curriculum needed to be modernized in some sense and taught as a core curriculum, beginning with a kind of march through the levels of organization that characterize biological systems. So you go from molecule and cell to organism and organization of functions within an organism, and ultimately to evolution, ecology, and behavior. And we really did try to teach a core curriculum with different faculty members doing the teaching, but some of us doing the interstitial work to hold the team together. So I think it was a good project for the department. I would be immodest to claim that it marked a change in the way biology was taught in other places, because I think every place more or less did it its own way. But we thought it was a very good one for us.
When you're engaged in an activity like that as chairman, is it easy to reach consensus and move the process along, or is there some head knocking to move the agenda forward?
I think we were very lucky. We had very strong representations at all of the levels in biology, cell, organism, population. I think we did not have the usual or the sometimes occurrence of disagreements between fields about who gets the next appointment in the department. We had a real appetite for balance in terms of levels of organization. And so Charlie Yanofsky, who would represent the molecular biology extreme brilliantly, Paul Ehrlich, who represents the ecology and population biology extreme brilliantly, were good friends and sort of led a kind of attitude in the department that we work to create the kind of breadth that we treasured and that we would get along with it together.
Did your history as a scientist and as a teacher facilitate your ability to be president of Stanford? I mean, were you drawing on all the skills that you had acquired to do that job of president?
It's hard to know. I mean, I think that having been a faculty member and having been a department chair, having organized or helped to organize a curriculum, having then run an interdisciplinary program because I was chairman of the human biology program here, which involved merging some biology with the social sciences, I think those helped in terms of developing the knowledge about how you bring out consensus. What really happens in universities that changes them are largely initiatives that grow up out of faculty members meeting other faculty members, discovering that they have converging interests and saying we ought to do something interesting to get, as a group or get the university to support a different way of approaching a particular set of problems.
So in a way, you part of the job is facilitating what's in the air, so to speak, as the faculty are drawn to new ideas and new teaching and research challenges.
Sometimes it's that. Sometimes you may need to do a little bit of planting. But I think encouraging good initiatives and trying to establish some enthusiasms based on your own sense of what the institution's priorities are is a skill that university presidents ought to have, and I think they're likelier to have it if they've spent a good amount of time as members of that university's faculty.
As president, you must have to worry a lot about the actual education that the students are getting, you know, changes in society, changes in the culture, and how does the curriculum adapt? What does leadership look like in that piece of the job?
Well, I think one thing is that leadership, and I mean both faculty leadership and administrative leadership, have to identify problems that are critical to society, because some people are really interested in problems that form the focus of a number of different disciplines and require interdisciplinary attention. And I think recognizing those problems is an important aspect of seeing to it that the university's work is somehow in tune with social needs. You can't have a 100% recipe based on that maxim, because you can't ignore classic disciplines that may for a moment appear not so relevant to contemporary society, but they may turn out to be 10 years from now just the very most important things around. So maintaining strengths but emphasizing new opportunities and possibilities, it has to go on together.
Let's separate undergraduate from graduate education, because at a liberal arts college like Stanford, it would seem to be very important to think about introducing courses, say science courses, for students who aren't going to become scientists, so that they can be informed citizens.
I've spent a lot of my my time as a teacher teaching in courses that were explicitly designed for students who weren't going to be science majors. I enjoyed that activity very much. And I think that science departments and scientists who ignore the important social prospects of turning out citizens who are going to be intelligent voters on issues that contain large amounts of science and technology in them, as many do today, that we will have failed in an important task. The problem is that measuring the value we add to a given cohort of students or even to any individual student, it is a difficult task. We all know that the students we have at Stanford go out and do very interesting and wonderful things, and you can count one success after the other. Then you have to ask yourself, well, suppose we had locked them in a motel in Western Nevada and asked them to interact a lot with one another. Would they turn out pretty good? And the answer is, well, if you take in smart enough people and you don't screw them up, mm-hmm. The chances are that you're going to have a good output, which will not really take you very far to answering the question, what value did I add?
Mm-hmm. And if you were trying to undertake such a course, is it hard to draw in, to make things truly interdisciplinary? I mean, I know that in theory, all universities want to do that and so on. But for example, I'm at the Institute of International Studies, and it's often difficult to make that happen because of the commitment, the time, and the energy that faculty devote to their discipline and department.
Yeah, it is. The trick is to make it permanent. We established a new teaching program in the program in human biology. It's now been going for nearly 40 years. My successors have done a pretty good job at at their own challenge of succession planning and bringing in new groups of faculty members to do the teaching and to run the program. The trouble is that many good ideas have sunsets when the institution or the foundation that has supported them no longer is willing to say, this is something that's important for us to do, and so we have to find the resources to keep it going. So I would say that resource limitation and sort of exhaustion of busy people is the big risk. We'd all like to have wonderful new programs and think of them as lasting forever. They won't. The buildings won't either. And maybe we all need to adjust to a much more generational style of of evaluating what we do and its worth.
You started off in aspects of environmental studies. I mean, and you said that you were interested in the environment and nature very early in your life. Should the universities be thinking now about how to elevate that as we confront these environmental crises? I mean, I know the science is doing the work, but at a certain point, it would seem that the environmental challenge is going to become a much broader issue. What would that dynamic be like, basically, so that you have much more on the environment than you already have?
Well, it is seen as such a significant societal problem that institutions will naturally be determined to start major programs in environmental science with a strong research base and a graduate base, as we have it at Stanford. That, of course, does not automatically solve the problem of what about students that aren't going into science and how can we arrange to teach them enough about the science that's relevant to these particular challenges that they will go out into society and be wise advocates and voters. Look at Al Gore. Now, I don't suppose Al Gore had a lot of science in college. Mm-hmm. And certainly when he was a congressman, when I was FDA commissioner, I testified before him a couple times. And he was a thoughtful and devoted guy. But you didn't see any of this. Now, here's a person who managed to convince himself about a real worry and pursue it with some passion, get a lot of good scientific support and advice, and suddenly make a huge difference in the way society feels about this particular problem. If we had good models for producing more of these kinds of people, it would be neat.
And in his case, it was a course that he took, I think, at Harvard. I can't remember by who, but yeah.
It may well have been when I was an undergraduate at Harvard, much before Al Gore. There was a course called Government and the Conservation of Natural Resources. Mm. It was taught in the government department, not in the biology department or any such place. I took it and was very enthusiastic about it, and it opened my eyes to the problems of land use and changes in the land and water availability and so forth that I wouldn't have gotten as readily in a biology course because it was taught by a guy who was on the policy front.
Mm-hmm. Looking at your tenure as president of Stanford, what do you think were the biggest challenges that you had to confront?
You get so many different ones that relate to different constituencies. The greatest challenge that we had with our student body was the fact that large numbers of them, bless them, were really concerned about South Africa and apartheid and strongly urged the administration and the Board of Trustees to do a blanket divestiture. We didn't think that was the right way to do it. We thought the right way to do it was to look at the performance of a number of companies in which Stanford held investments, challenge the officers of those companies, find out how they were doing with respect to the Sullivan principles, which were important principles at the time, and then to make a decision. We divested a few, but we did it on a case-by-case basis because we thought that was the fairest and most reasonable way to do it. We also thought that having a program in which we were examining this prospect was likely to sustain pressure against that government a little better than a statement that we were getting rid of all of it tomorrow and then have to answer the question, okay, are you still in the game?
Mm-hmm. Are there any decisions that you made in retrospect that you would do in a different way?
Some people will know that Stanford had a real problem with indirect cost recovery with the government. We think that we were doing it in the right way, according to negotiated memoranda of understanding. We got a very hard time in a hearing on the Hill in which I was the Stanford witness. There were some aspects of our management of the indirect cost business that were embarrassing. And we... So my error in that was certainly not smelling it out earlier than I did. There were some faculty concerns that I probably should have been more responsive to. So that's one. I can't think of anything with respect to the South Africa decisions. I thought those were generally about right. And with respect to supporting university programs, as every president needs to do, we had a major capital campaign, the first billion-dollar plus campaign in higher education history at the time. Now everybody's way over that number, but I think we set a strong mark in making it with a little extra, so that people knew that level of support was possible.
The overhead crisis, of course, relates to the relationship of government to science, which is the focus of the Kerr lectures that you're giving on the campus. So let's talk a little about that, because I have the sense in reading your book that the storm over the overhead was a kind of a new level of politicization of that relationship that in some ways was unexpected.
Not the only a new level, but certainly a very important one. I mean, it was a pretty singular event in history. Other universities were looking at it carefully, and of course, it did produce a temporary policy lowering the rate of recovery, which is now mostly recovered. I guess that I think the most interesting generality that you can draw from that experience is that it wasn't the only one. That is, there were challenges about indirect cost recovery. There were challenges about cost sharing. Universities were being asked to do more in the partnership with government support than they had been in the beginning. There was more regulation with respect to teaching students about the honorable conduct of research and so forth. So there were government successful efforts to say something about the curriculum, which at the beginning might not have sounded like such a terrific deal to many faculty members. So it's a relationship that's not without its difficulties. Nowadays, with industry support of university research causing a lot of attention and many people asking hard questions, are we corrupting the universities? Nobody asked those questions in the beginning about the government support. Everybody was saying what a great thing it is that Vannevar Bush says that all this military science ought to be decanted and funded and funds used to pay for basic research in the universities.
Vannevar Bush was a visionary in a way in laying out an agenda. You talked about that. Help us understand, or help our audience understand, what his the frontiers of science, the endless frontiers of science was, and really what it meant for the growth of universities that followed.
One of the things I did in getting the first Kerr lecture ready was to read The Endless Frontier, which is actually a memorandum responding to five questions or four that Roosevelt had asked the year before. Of course, the response went to Truman. What it said essentially was, fundamental science is the groundwork for all of the development and application activity that produces vital engines in our economy. If you want a vigorous economy, if you want to improve the nation's health, if you want to deal with its problems effectively, if you want a strong defense establishment, what you have to have is a platform of fundamental research from the universities that can then be turned into services and products that serve society. Well, it was a brilliant vision, and he wanted a national research foundation with a set of divisions, with a lot of sort of civilian control, and one of them was to be defense, another one was to be health. The others were devoted to different kinds of basic science. Well, he got disappointed because he didn't get health. That went to NIH. He didn't get defense because the defense agencies began their own programs to support fundamental research. Bush felt outflanked in a political sense by that result. But he did get a National Science Foundation, and that was an important achievement. And the basic concept that the government was going to fund fundamental research and then industry and other kinds of organizations would scoop up the proceeds, the intellectual proceeds of that, and use them to develop economically viable products.
And how do you account for the successful implementation of this extraordinary vision? I mean, were we riding the wave of the success in World War II and then had this extraordinary position vis-a-vis other actors in the international system?
We had a terrific position. I mean, the institutions, research institutions of Western Europe were terribly handicapped in the aftermath of the war. Those governments were having to be significantly helped by us. Japan was, of course, in recovery mode. Only now are you beginning to see the scientific institutions in those countries now beginning to rival ours in terms of prize-winning efforts and so forth in fundamental research. But partly, I think, our success is due not just to the war and to success in the war, but to the quality of the Bush decision. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was really something that no other country would have done, could have done, and it could have been very different here. You could have said, we want all the national laboratories to double in size, and we're going to put all the basic research money in there. A lot of countries would have been seriously tempted to decide the matter that way.
Mm-hmm. So in a way, it was, as you suggested in your lecture, it was really like the frontier that we had in earlier in our history, in the sense, go get it, was the signal to
yes,
universities.
Exactly.
So it guidance, but not over-regulation.
That's right. It was described widely as a partnership between government and the universities.
Was the additive here brought by the Cold War and, of course, the challenge of Sputnik? Did that just increase the commitment to supporting universities with limited regulation?
It certainly increased attention to support of the universities and support of basic science. It also produced some government reorganization. Remember that NASA came into being shortly after Sputnik. At the same time, the Congress passed the National Defense Education Act, so serious attention was being paid to educating people in the sciences at the graduate level, sciences and other relevant disciplines at the graduate level, and you had the first presidential science advisor. President Killian from MIT came down and was Eisenhower's science advisor. So you had the establishment of some instruments for dealing with what we're doing in science. The biggest effect of Sputnik was a surge of attention to science education in K-12. Mm-hmm. And it produced a lot of professional contact between, for example, secondary school science teachers and university academicians. I remember making several trips to high schools in the immediately post-Sputnik era. And there were lots of university scientists who joined in teams to produce, say, new curricula or textbooks for chemistry in chem study. For physics, you had Jerry Zacharias and others starting to worry about physics curricula and to the biological sciences curriculum study with which I was somewhat involved began preparing new textbooks and curricula for high school biology teachers.
Why has that not occurred a second time since Sputnik, or has it? Namely, the sense that, well, science is really important, we've got to put money into it, but we've also got to put money into the education at the lower levels.
Well, science education reform is part of the larger package of comprehensive education reform. The trouble with, as a student of the process of education reform says, the problem is not that schools don't change. They change promiscuously. They just don't get better. People are discouraged that there aren't, that good models of practice here don't infect standards of practice here. That is, there's not a lot of infectivity in the system so that models don't communicate their success readily. I don't know what the forcing function will be that would be equivalent to Sputnik. I've speculated that maybe climate change and the deep concern that now the majority of our citizens are feeling about the threat of changes in average global temperature might do it, but we'll have to see. So far, not a conspicuous sign that it has
happened or about to happen.
Yeah.
The second phase that you identified in your lectures of the relationship of government to universities, what you call the Bayh-Dole period. Tell us a little about that, because there was a very different view of the frontier of science.
Yeah. The period you're talking about began in the late 70s when a number of congressmen, congressional committees, began to ask whether the product of this decision to generate all this support for university science was producing enough transferable result to provide the kind of base for industry development that Bush had envisioned. How about the patents, they said? Where are the patents? Well, there weren't a very impressive number. And eventually, after a series of hearings, a package of amendments due to Senators Bayh and Dole were passed by the Congress. And by those amendments, the United States government gave up any intellectual property rights to discoveries made in universities. They could either go to the innovators who made the inventions, or they could go to the universities themselves, whichever policy they had. Most universities had the policy that they would patent, then the principal investigators might enjoy some profits from those patents or from the licenses that could be sold based on those patents. What actually happened more commonly was that faculty members would come to their university with a great idea. The university would patent it. At the same time, the professor would have been talking to some venture capitalists or to some outside friends who were prepared to fund a new company. There would be a startup developed in the lands next to the university, or perhaps even on the university's own lands by lease. And the company would then begin producing products based on the licenses it had from that patent. Well, that produced an interesting set of problems for the presidents of universities, for example. Should the university invest its endowment in the success of these faculty-spawned companies? What should the licensing policies be like? Should there be a firewall between the professor's on-campus lab and his off-campus venture? Would graduate students go back and forth, and would they be coerced to do so? Host of problems that we had to wrestle with in the middle 80s. And much of what I talked about in the lecture yesterday was how the Bayh-Dole amendments had created a new set of relationships in which industry was now a much more serious cooperative player, even partner with government.
Do the challenges of this Bayh-Dole period and Stanford's response on a whole array of issues help us understand anything about the development of Silicon Valley in the bosom, so to speak, of Stanford? Because that relationship stands out, you know, as a unique one in which somehow the university spawns ideas that nurture an environment which is very near to Stanford, and there seems to be a real synergy there.
It's very interesting. I think that the fact that there's a lot of very interesting high-tech, science-rich corporate activity going on in Silicon Valley is actually a product of much earlier relationships. Mm. Way before this, you had some inventions involving, for example, the klystron tube, the use of linear accelerators in diagnostic or cancer therapy. You had a number of items in which a role was played by Stanford faculty before any of this rule book got set out with Stanford companies. Or Stanford graduate students with a good idea would go out and start their own in a garage in Palo Alto as Hewlett-Packard began. So all of these were early, and so I don't think they can be said to result from the instrumental changes that were made in Bayh-Dole, although the atmosphere in Silicon Valley set up by those early successes has certainly encouraged the kind of venture capital environment and the investment opportunities that enrich the possibilities generated by Bayh-Dole.
A third element that you're going to address in future lectures with regard to universities and government and the pursuit of science is national security issues. And without asking you to tell us about your future lecture, it would seem that in the post 9/11 world, we're really confronting a number of challenges where the vitality of universities could potentially be threatened by rules and regulations that over-determine how our country responds to the terrorist threat. Talk a little about that. I mean, what is your sense of that? Is there a lot here that we have to worry about, not just from the terrorists, but also from the threat to universities posed by a new over-regulation?
This has a much earlier history, and I want to point out how much of it was happening in the early 1980s. Remember that the Cold War was a very active concern at that time, and there were a number of government responses in the early Reagan years that would have restricted the attendance of foreign graduate students at seminars, would have employed rules by which we would have to limit the eligibility of visitors from other countries, not friendly countries, to U.S. labs. So this was bothering the scientific community a lot, and we undertook some things to try to work our way through it. I was a co-chair with the Undersecretary for Research and Engineering in Defense of a DOD universities consortium that tried to solve these problems. The problem was that all kinds of regulations that were short of absolute secrecy, short of classification, were restricting these relationships between visitors from foreign countries and graduate students in our own country and projects here. Finally, after a lot of maneuvering, President Reagan signed a directive called National Security Defense Directive 189, which said, we're not going to do anything short of classification to restrict fundamental research visits or data exchange or whatever, which is very good. The Secretary of State, actually before she became Secretary of State in the post 9/11 period, Condoleezza Rice, reaffirmed in a letter to President Chuck Vest of MIT that NSDD 189 was still in force and that these other classification, short of classification restrictions, would not apply.
This was before 9/11.
This was after.
Oh, after 9/11. Okay, good.
So despite that, some research projects were known as sensitive but unclassified, and you're supposed not to talk about them, and some contract monitors were insisting on that. So despite what was a presidential executive order, lots of people in the middle-level bureaucracy were applying their own preferred standards instead. So that has been a difficult wicket to go through, and it's still a problem. For example, the Office of Foreign Assets Control in the Department of the Treasury says that if you have a scientist in Iran or Cuba or whatever that submits an article to an American journal, editing the article for clarity involves a service to an unauthorized non-national, that is, if it comes from a non-waiver country. I was tempted to publish a perfectly terrible piece from one of those countries without editorial corrections, with a note saying, this is the uncorrected version, so that we were not in violation of the OFAC rules.
So as editor of science, you're running against some of the same problems that you would have run up against as president of Stanford.
The public is concerned about publication of things that might help bad people. There was a big meeting at the National Academy of Sciences between a lot of security types quite reasonable ones and scientists, in which one of the security people said, well, you guys wouldn't feel very good. He was talking to a microbiologist. You guys wouldn't feel very good if one of your papers turned up in a cave in Afghanistan with a lot of yellow highlighting on the reprint. And everybody said, it was plain that there were some security issues about the publication process itself. We published essentially a manufactured bacteriophage virus. We have published other kinds of papers. In fact, the reconstitution of the 1918 smallpox. The Spanish influenza virus from 1918, and having done that, we were criticized a little bit, and for taking the risk of making such a pathogen knowledge about such a pathogen available to others. But a thoughtful committee appointed by the National Academies has looked at all the papers that have been published and has said, by and large, they're okay. But there's a new agency in government that's going to try to provide some guidelines about what kinds of publication might create problems of this kind. So we'll see what happens.
One looks at your career, these various roles you've had, everything from scientist to chairman of a department to president of Stanford, to commissioner of the Federal Drug Administration. What insight have you gotten about how all of these different perspectives that you have in these different roles can sort of come together to move ahead into the future with regard to issues such as the environment? I mean, because as commissioner, I guess you must have gotten a sense of something different because you were actually in the government, not advising the government or dealing with the government.
I find myself deeply interested in the uses of science by society. In other words, in the connection between science and public policy. I think it's been useful for me, for my understanding of that process, to have been engaged in it as a product of a producer of fundamental science, none of which turns out to have produced any products, but which has produced perhaps some useful insights to other scientists, as a person in charge of a university which provides a great deal of fundamental science, but constantly wonders how it ought to shape itself to be of greater service to the society that supports it. Having been head of a regulatory agency that attempts to strike a balance between uses of information and restrictions on technologies that might develop harm, it certainly hasn't made me an expert in a field that's essentially a collision between the way societies govern themselves and the way they make use of scientific information. But I think it's a fascinating problem, and I think having seen it from different angles has been helpful to me in trying to understand it better.
But do you see, is there hope that somehow we will develop between all of these different institutions a consensus about how to move forward? I guess what I have in mind is the politicization that we're seeing that you first experienced in the indirect cost controversy and so on, where an issue is blown all out of proportion, which has negative consequences for what universities might want to do. One thinks about all sorts of things like Middle East studies, where it seems like there's a crisis a day. The whole question of stem cell research, you know, where religious values are being introduced into a discussion about what the government could support and so on. So is there some way that we will move forward, not on a particular issue, but generally as a society, so we can have that synergy between, you know, universities, the government, you know, as they meet in the undertaking of science?
I'm very optimistic about our capacity as a society to arrive at solutions following a period of negotiation and even of conflict. The deep question is, are certain things changing so fast that the issue is not can we do it, is it can we do it in time? And there I'm a little less, I'm more concerned about our capacity to be alert and mobile as a society than about my belief that the society can ever find a kind of consensus and find itself in agreement with itself. We're awfully polarized in this country right now, and I think that's a disturbing fact that may argue that to do things as quickly as we will have to do them will be a big challenge.
And are you talking specifically about environmental issues or science more generally?
I'm thinking in terms of the timing of response and action, I'm thinking particularly of the climate crisis because I think it's very real, and I think it's going to require more alacrity than our society has frequently been able to show.
Are you seeing, as editor-in-chief of Science, in the papers that are coming across your desk, that the scientific community really sees this as a top priority?
I think the scientific community absolutely sees it as a top priority. We are getting so many more papers on ice sheet dynamics and projections of sea level rise and the relationship between sea surface temperature and hurricane intensity, aspects of both paleoclimatology that might help us understand what might happen next, or measurements of certain values that are important for us to understand, like, you know, the changing pH of the ocean.
One final question, and that is this. If students were watching this program, how would you advise them to prepare themselves for the future, either as a scientist or a public policy person who's interested in the issues raised by science? Any advice for them, other than to go to Stanford, of course, but beyond that?
Any advice I would give could be taken as seriously by Cal students, for whom I have great respect, and Stanford students, for whom I also have great respect. Look, in preparing yourself for a later life, whether you're in high school or in college, one important thing to do is to think about what concerns you and what concerns your family and what concerns your friends and what concerns your society. And think about the problems that have to be solved to get us to a point in which one is comfortable with the direction. That's really a piece of advice to study what interests you the most, because there's no point in doing something that you think is important if you also think it's dull as hell. I think people need to impose their natural curiosity on problems that interest them deeply and that may have some implication for the society they're part of.
On that note, Professor Kennedy, I want to thank you for coming to the campus, delivering the Kerr Lectures, and taking the time to be on our program. Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.